A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Only in Law School podcast presented by the Comedians of Law. I'm your host, Matt Ritter, and with me this week is Indidio Rigi.
Hello!
What's up?
How you doing, Matt?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
So I've been trying to get everybody who now we've sort of renewed the podcast. I'd like to just jump in and give everybody a little background. Where do you go to law school? What are you doing with your the legal side? Is in-house the dream that everybody in the big law thinks it is?
I guess it's a dream if you are currently in big law because, there are a lot of things, I think most of the things that are not fun or annoying about working in big law, you can leave behind if you go in-house. Most folks really hate having to take, sort of write down all their time. I don't even know what it's called anymore.
We call that billing. I believe they call that billing.
Billing. Matt, I literally, my mind was like, what is it called when you have to write down your time?
In 6-minute increments? Yeah, billing.
Billing. How is that word pronounced? Billing?
Yeah, billing. Yeah, it's terrible.
I've forgotten that, right? I've been in house like almost 6 years.
If you're listening to this podcast, that's all you need to know about how much better her life is than anyone who works at a firm. She doesn't even remember the term billing.
But yeah, I feel like those things that are sort of annoying about working at the firm and then, billing as well as kind of the, I don't know what other folks do, but I remember when I was doing M&A, it was sort of a very erratic schedule, especially when you're much more junior and you're kind of waiting around for other people. And so I did a lot of waiting around until, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning to look at things and then working until 3 or 4.
Yeah, that was the worst. You're just, like, sitting around from the time that you could be home, like, sleeping.
Yep. And so that part of it, I don't miss at all. And I think that's what makes it feel like a dream to people to come in-house. But I think if you're coming in-house thinking, oh, I'm going to be working less, forget about it. Like, I think I work just as much now. It's just that I control my time. And so it's a little bit more, livable. You're able to kind of fit it into your life a little bit more than working at the law firm.
The flip side is you can't make $2 million, right?
No, right. They're not going to pay you $2 million to control your own schedule, no.
Yeah.
I think that, depending on what you're interested in, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, my particular interest was in television, but a lot of people who are, working in-house at Goldman Sachs, they're doing sort of law firm hours, and a lot of them are getting law firm pay, and so you can find in-house positions where you can, get not exactly comparable, but definitely competitive pay for doing similar, types of work, if you enjoy that type of work. But if you want to switch over to something else, then you have to kind of also adjust your expectations as far as how much you're going to get paid.
And are they supporting the comedy dream over there?
I don't think that they have any problems with it. I'm sure if I blew up all of a sudden, maybe they'd try to get 10%. They say, hey, you're working for us. But
yeah.
Yeah, I think most of the folks, lawyers are always supportive of other lawyers that do other things.
The ones that are, we're living everybody's dream.
Exactly. So no one's really, said anything bad to me about it. And I think my boss, he thinks it's hilarious.
Don't you feel like in a weird way, like, I don't know, I feel like everybody who says that, who they all support, I feel like they should all give money towards it, though. Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, it's sort of like when you have like one person from your town who's trying to make it and everybody chips in, to send them to college or something, it's like.
Exactly. Let's have a rent party. Put in a little bit of money.
Yeah, rent party. Exactly. Throw a little rent party for us if you're really supporting our dream.
I knew a couple of people. One guy was, he wrote a book. Another person and a professional dancer before she came to law school, and she kept doing it. So I was always impressed with the people who did that in law school, who were able to really maintain their creative side while they were, you know, going to school full time, which is not easy.
Yeah, that's definitely pretty hard to do. Just actually trying to like pursue that while you're trying to learn, you know, just absorb copious amounts of information that's pretty useless. That's just dulling the senses. Hey, should we jump into these news stories? We got some good ones.
Yeah.
You know, this Donald Sterling thing keeps on going. It's like the gift that keeps on giving for legal commentators such as ourselves. Yeah, I mean, it's the worst gift. He's the worst gift, but when you're a humorist, he's, you know, he's great.
Right, right.
It's great to have a guy who's so out of touch with the rest of the universe. You know what's amazing to me? I actually think, I always think about these things in terms of who are the people around you that allow this total lack of awareness and behavior? Yeah, you're like, what? I have to start hunting human beings or something for a sport.
Yeah, literally, that's what I say. I'm always like, you know what? Let me not get that rich. I need to just be rich enough to pay off my law school loans, to be able to, you know, buy a house and pay off the mortgage on my apartment, that type of thing, and not have any kind of debt. But I would feel like a winner at that point because I feel like he was so wealthy and he's been wealthy for so long. That really, I doubt anyone around him was telling him, like, hey, guy, you know, maybe you shouldn't say those things, even if you think that.
Right.
And my thing is, you know, smart rich people, they have PR people. They have people around them who can really help them that, you know, you can have the most heinous views, but nobody has to know about it.
Yeah. But you know, but I guess my point is, right, it's like, yeah, I agree with you. You get to a certain point and you're you know, nobody's going to say no. But, you know, he was surrounded by other millionaires. You know, I mean, first of all, you know, in a weird way, I don't know. I feel like this is one of those things where I read a couple of good articles about it. I thought a couple of people made some good points. It's like, yeah, he said this stuff, but he also was blatantly practicing discriminatory housing and nobody did anything.
Right.
You like these, that's sort of a bigger deal. He was affecting people's lives.
Right.
And I don't know. It's weird. It's weird how in the sports realm, it seems like something really huge has to happen for people to acknowledge your bad moral, you know, attitudes.
Right. Yeah, I think it's also, you know, it's one of those things where this is a thing that everyone can kind of get behind, and people, meaning that everyone can say, oh, we agree, everything he said was just so horrible, and you hear it, it's not like a little snippet, you know, it doesn't sound like he said it in anger, it sounds like they're having a long conversation, and he's espousing these views that he's obviously held for a long time. But then the thing that's more troubling is that, like you said, when things are actually affecting people's lives and they have the type of racism where he's, you know, not renting apartments to, you know, black people or to Hispanic people and says all sorts of heinous things about them, then it's just not as urgent to people. It's kind of like, you know, he does that. But then he says something against, you know, Magic Johnson, who's probably the black person who needs the least protection from Donald Sterling.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone's in an outrage.
Well, that's what, I mean, the reason I say that is because, you know, I think there's not enough healthy debate in this country these days. I feel like everybody, you know, especially with social media, just wants to flood an avalanche on something so easy. Like, it's so easy to take. I mean, there's not an argument here, you know? Which to me, it's like, well, you know, how about we engage, you know, when it's like, when there's actually a debate to be had about, you know, everybody agrees the guy's, you know, a monster. Which is why I think the only interesting debate in this whole thing is what to do now with his team. I think there's actually a legal debate here to be had.
Encouraging him. him to sell the, or forcing him to sell the team. And when I looked it up, you actually have to, he kind of has their own, you know, the league has its own sort of due process, right? So it has to, he can't be forced to sell the team unless he has, there's a vote of three quarters of the league owners, which is about 23 of the 30 owners, right?
Right.
And to, in order for that to even happen, for a vote to happen, someone, and I guess it's going to be Silver in this case, you know, the head, he's going to be, he's going to have to file like a written charge, and then Sterling's going to have 5 days to respond, and then they would have to call a vote, and then you could, you know, have the vote to get the three quarters of the, of the, of the, of the league to approve the forced sale. And if all of that happens, then he has to sell, he has to sell the team. Which, you know, I can understand from the perspective of the owners of the league. I mean, he's making the NBA look really, really bad. You know, it's not, if they don't look very progressive. I mean, they, the teams are, you know, majority black, many of the teams, including the Clippers, and it's not really something that they can just kind of gloss over, or they, I mean, I feel like they had to do this, you know? They didn't really have much choice. I mean, I can't imagine what else they could have said that would have been okay in this case.
Yeah, but, you know, what I thought was interesting, you know, Mark Cuban originally, you know, jumped on the slippery slope argument about forcing somebody to sell, you know, private assets because of, you know, private thoughts in his own home. And I went online and I made a funny post. I thought it was funny on Facebook. I made a funny post. I said, well, let's take a look at these owners and see who's next. I mean, you've got Cleveland's owner who was at the epicenter of the subprime mortgage crisis. You've got Mikhail Prokhorov, who made his money during the collapse of the Russian economy, which means he definitely did a lot of bad things. The list goes on. I'm just, you know, my question is, where do we draw a line on these sort of things? I mean, is it just that, hey, these are the rules, and, you know, he's already, you know, he's put the NBA in such a position where this is the only course of action? Right, I'm saying, but isn't that really scary for the owners now? I mean, to think about, you know, sort of their private affairs being subject to losing, you know, basically a very lucrative franchise. Oh, yeah. I agree. And I liked what Adam Silver said. He said, I don't care if they were his private thoughts originally. They're now public knowledge.
Exactly. And so if we, I think it's different using the example of the podcast because we're putting out the podcast knowing people will listen to it. But I agree. I wouldn't want anyone taping, you know, my private conversations. I'm not, you know, saying anything crazy like he's saying. But, you know, anything that's yours that's private, you don't want that black. You don't want that to be broadcast to the whole world. But once it's out there, there's no sort of taking it back. There's no, okay, well, we know that he has these really deeply held beliefs about, you know, black people, about people of color. We're all just going to forget that because it's his private thought. It's out there, and they have to deal with it.
Do you think it was also bigger because this was, I mean, this was sort of like a landmark moment in sort of race relations in sports, too. Do you feel like this was a tipping point in some way?
Yeah. the thing, you know, the, just taking a slightly different side, I thought it was interesting. His wife, did you hear his wife, Rochelle Sterling, she released a statement, and her statement was basically saying how she's been talking to Silver, you know, and how she supports his decision to ban her estranged husband, and that, you know, she hopes that they can find somebody who is the highest moral character, you know, to take over the team. And a couple of commentators were talking about how, you know, California is a community property state, and so she is also part owner of the Clippers, and she's kind of protecting her investment.
I mean, it brings up a very interesting point, because what evidence do you have to strip her of the team? Yeah.
So I don't know that her name is anywhere.
But what do you think about that? I mean, what do you think about the, just in general? I mean, you know, because I've heard a lot of people saying, well, it's got to leave the family. The ownership has to leave the family. I mean, is she sort of dirtied just by association? Is her whole, you know, what if her, you know, are her and her son too dirty just by association to then be the owners of this team? Does he have to sell? Real shady. She supposedly snuck around finding out if people were minorities in buildings.
Exactly. In those apartments that he would have rented to people. So,
by the way, that's a real loyal wife to do something that sleazy.
That's a lot of dedication, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I feel like she's not exactly, you know, an angel, but I think ultimately none of us are, right? If you start digging, you'll find something that you don't disagree with about everyone's life. But hey, I'm not a millionaire.
Right. Well, I think that was Cuban's point, because Cuban, I don't think... was worried about being called a racist, but he's got radical views on lots of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always, you know, sort of based on your perspective, right?
You know, but I'm just saying, you know, because then you go down this, right, it's like, I guess what he's worried about is like, hey, well, what if he's pro-choice and all the other owners are pro-life, you know? I mean, who knows where it can go down that. Yeah.
It's only 30 people. It's a small group. You know, they're a conglomerate. They can decide who they want and don't want. So, yeah, if someone has a view that they disagree with, it's 30 people. It's not as though this is a political office or something where he's getting a vote and, you know, all these people agree with him. Hey, if they decide, you know what, we don't want anyone who, you know, is pro-choice and we're all pro-life, we don't want that, that's up to them, you know. And these guys are millions upon millions upon millionaires. So I don't really think that, again, that they're so concerned about what people believe, because obviously this guy's been in the NBA for 33 years. You know, he's the longest tenured owner in the NBA, so he's been around forever, and he's had.
Is he the longest tenured? I didn't even realize that.
Yep, and he's been around for 33 years. He's been around forever, and clearly all of the things he's done leading up to now was not affecting their bottom line. Or believe me, they would have gotten rid of him a long time ago. As soon as it hits their pocket.
Yeah. I think that's a good analogy, and he usually gets paid handsomely to get out.
Yeah.
I'm very interested to see who ends up with the team, you know? I would like to see Oprah Winfrey.
You know, I feel like Oprah's already got too much. I mean, she's got the chai tea now at Starbucks. She's got the TV show.
That's too much? She can't have the chai tea and the Clippers? That's too much? Yeah, and I think that it seems like in a good way there's a strong push for like, hey, you know what, maybe let's look at a minority owner for this
right,
lot.
Right. You know, amazing. Think about that. You know, I mean, it's the interesting thing to me is think that it's a glaring thing when you look at, you know, if you look at pictures of the owners and it's, you know, all but one and maybe two are, you know, white men, and then you look at the players and, you know, the majority of them are, you know, black men. And I think it's an uncomfortable thing that is easy to kind of continue to, I would say ignore, but just kind of like not focus on. But then when these types of things happen, you have to look at that and you have to say, okay, that's not just coincidence. You know, like, who has the resources to...
Yeah. You know what's funny about that? Like, I felt creepy, like... The one thing that really creeped me out when you say that is, like, the one thing that where he used to bring women into the locker room and say, look at these beautiful black bodies, like, that just was so creepy.
I mean, he just generally sounds creepy.
Yeah, but I think it just brought into light, you know, that whole sort of, like, dichotomy between you have a league that is primarily black and they're the labor pool. You know, and you have, you know, all basically like almost every other owner being white. But I think we are at a point where, like, you know, look, they just made a list of like 10 minority, you know, potential owners that have the money.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the great point to make, is that, you know, things are changing. I mean, I think that the fact that this guy is sort of being, you know, roundly criticized for what he said. Everyone says, hey, you know, you can have any thoughts you want. But the fact that he is sort of broadcasting these thoughts, whether he's saying them to his quote-unquote girlfriend or personal assistant or whoever she is.
Who is she? What is she? What is she?
That's funny because we haven't really talked about
it. I don't mean what race is she. I mean, what is she? Is she a creature of this earth? Is she an alien life form? I don't know what she is.
No, what I think is interesting is that, you know, it's very tough to kind of pin it down. At some point, they were saying she was actually employed by him and she was getting paid on the books, and she did the Barbara Walters interview this week on Friday, where she was saying, you know, that she was being paid by him on the books, and then she was kind of being paid off the books. And the funniest thing is that in the Barbara Walters interview, they identified her as a personal assistant, and I was like, I thought she was like his archivist or something, and that's why she was recording everything they said. I mean, she's just had all kinds of things, you know, thrown around, but it really seems that when you have a young woman who is, you know, there's a 50-year age difference between them, and she's getting money, and the wife is suing her for, you know, seducing her husband. I, you know, I wasn't there, and I can't testify to it, but it does seem like there was more going on than just a personal assistant.
Oh, yeah. I actually think she was created by some program on Instagram. They have, like... There's all kinds of new, you know, there's like, you know, the world is getting weird. There's like robots and there's clones and stuff. Now you can actually create a 3D mistress. It's and you can program her, but once she becomes self-aware, it's like in Terminator.
Right.
You know, once the mistress becomes self-aware, it's a real bad situation for you.
It's interesting. Speaking of being self-aware, you can tell that he has no self-awareness, you know, because...
Oh, I think, I think he just has bad vision. I think he thought she was white.
And he said in one of the debates, he said something like, you know, beautiful, you're supposed to be this delicate white, I mean, delicate Latina woman. And I was like, but he didn't rent apartments to Latino people either. You know,
yeah. Well, I think it proves I think it blows through the theory that you can't say you're not racist just because you have a black friend.
Exactly. He's like, hey, how can I be racist? Some of my best mistresses are
black. Yeah, he's like, come on, some of my highest paid escorts are minorities. This is absurd. I can't believe these accusations.
Some of my basketball team are black.
Yeah. He's like, I clothe people that are black. This is crazy. Look, it's a fascinating story, you know, it really is, because it takes a story like this for us to start having dialogue about certain things that are uncomfortable.
I agree, and it's nice to have an opportunity to do that, because I think otherwise, you know, it's easier just to kind of go through life and ignore.
Oh, should we talk about Clooney? This is good.
Yeah, let's talk about that real quick.
George Clooney. Are you a Clooney fan, or are you just tired of his like smarmy? I think he's a little too smarmy for me. He's always got that smarmy smile. Like, he knows he's the best-looking, richest guy in the room, and he has no modesty to him.
I feel kind of like he's like one of those people who he maybe seems deeper than he is.
Well, that's why I thought the best thing that I thought... I don't know if you saw... So he and Steve Wynn got in a fight, which is hilarious in and of itself, over dinner. And apparently Wynn called the president an a-hole, and Clooney defended the president, which I think is cool, but at the same time, Clooney stormed out, and Steve Wynn went on a tirade. They went back and forth in the media, but Steve Wynn goes, yeah, Clooney's great to have around, but when he gets drunk, he starts pretending that he's, like, the best friends with the president, and it's really annoying. I agree. It's like, I don't want to disparage them doing good in the world because it's awesome.
Exactly. So I want to encourage that. But at the same time, I'm like, dude, is this really about them or is it about you?
Yeah. You know? Well, you know what it is, too? I think the problem is that like people just lend a little too much credence to what they say on these issues then.
Yes. And he's not an expert. Like, they're not experts in these things.
Yeah. Like, by the way, so he took a trip to Sudan. Like, by the way, there are people that have PhDs in studying these conflicts, you know?
Exactly.
But you know, look, it looks like he locked down a very successful lawyer.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is she went to NYU Law School, right? Where I also was at NYU Law School, and I kept trying to think that we had a lot of LLM students. I was like, I do not remember her. I'm trying to think.
Did you guys overlap?
Well, she's 36. I don't know when she went. I'm 37. I don't know when she went to school, but we're about the same age, so I kind of feel like
she doesn't seem like the type that would even sit in class, though. It seems like she's a law student, and she's already done so much that it seems like she... I don't know. We were talking about this, me and my friends. It seems like she had that sort of, like, socialite existence. Like, she's somehow, like, friends with presidents all over the world as a 20-something, you know? Like, it's kind
of... Well, they said her mom is, like, the Diane Sawyer of I can't remember what country she's from. Hold on. I gotta look at my
I think Bahrain? No, I don't know. Bahrain? No.
Lebanon,
yeah, because she's already on her resume. It says that she helped prosecute Milosevic, she helped defend the WikiLeaks guy.
Yeah.
She's a consultant to the King of Bahrain, and I'm like,
right. Well, I feel like she's gonna be kind of like you know how gay celebrities in the olden days used to have beards where they marry a woman and that would help them.
Yeah.
Stay in the closet and still, you know, give this image. She's gonna be his like.
Oh, totally. Like. Oh, see, I'm a serious guy. Well, actually, it's funny you say that because the rumor is that this is a political move to run for office.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Smart one, right? I mean, it sounds like exactly what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think she gives him, like, gravitas.
You know? Yeah, right. So, I mean, like, you know, if what you're saying is a commonly held view, then it seems like it would be the right move to start. If he's planning on a run for office, she's like the perfect, you know, on the road, you know, doing the press every city, shaking hands and having her take all the photo ops. I love that we've now gotten to the point where we're like, yeah, Clooney, he's damaged goods.
No, what I'm saying is, if you're her, right?
Yeah.
He wouldn't be damaged goods for like a regular woman or like any of those actresses he dated. That would definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd want to date. If I was an actress, I'd want to date a guy who directs movies because hey, I can get in movies. But I'm like, she's already highly accomplished. She doesn't seem to have any, at least from her background, any interest in like entertainment or anything like that. and she seems like she's kind of running in circles.
Yeah. So what I'm thinking is, I think we're both kind of hitting the nail on the head a little bit. I think they're both less than they seem. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what it is. If she's as great as her resume, there's no way. Why would she want to be with this guy who's been a playboy for 30 years, by the way?
Right.
Who's been a...
What do you think? Give it... how many years do you give it? Do you think they're going to be together forever? You think it's going to be a...
No, never. This guy, never. No, he's going to... He's not built that way. He will be with her until he either gets elected or doesn't get elected as the next governor. Whenever, I don't know what his plan is. If it's governor of California, I don't know. I think the second that doesn't work out, or if he's, you know, feeling cozy, he will move on to the next 28-year-old. He'll go back to the waitresses. Yeah, because also the other thing that I'm shocked is, at some point, right, you're George Clooney, you've dated a bevy of models and actresses, and those encounters, even if he dated them for 2 years, they were so one-sided. He's probably so set in his ways of thinking that he's right about everything, and I just don't see how that's going to work.
Yeah, and she doesn't seem to be the pushover type.
Who's going to do the dishes? No, but even though you pay people, you still argue about little things. Like, hey, can you get the remote? Like, they don't pay somebody to get the remote, do they?
I don't know if she watches TV. She seems like the kind who doesn't watch
TV. She doesn't watch TV. Ugh.
No, I'm reading newspapers.
Yeah, she goes, ugh, I don't watch TV. Ugh, I don't. And George Clooney's like, you are aware I started as a soap opera actor, right? Yeah, hey, all right, so I'm George. Hey, honey, do you want to watch The Real Housewives?
I'm sorry, what's Real Housewives? I'm not familiar. Is that a book?
Oh, no, it's amazing. It's these women, like, you know my buddy Kelsey Grammer?
Who's Kelsey Grammer? Is he a president of a...
Oh, you're joking. Come on, Kelsey Grammer, Cheers? Cheers to bet a bunch of guys in a bar?
What's Cheers? I don't understand.
It's the quintessential American sitcom. It's like before Seinfeld, you know? Seinfeld?
I'm sorry, I don't really watch American television or any television.
Oh my God. You know what? Oh man. What do you watch? I mean, do you watch documentaries at least?
I don't go to films. I learn languages. That's what I do in my spare time. For fun, I just learn different languages.
Wait, you mean to tell me you never saw ER? Yeah, I was on it for like 15 years.
I've never heard of it. Never heard of it.
All right, well, we're gonna. Would you watch ER right now with me? I feel like you need to. If this is gonna work out, you need to watch all my old television episodes.
No, you know, I actually have a medical degree as well, and I know that every hour of television I watch kills about a million brain cells.
Oh, that's ridiculous! I was on ER for 12 years. You know how much medical experience I have? No. I inhabited a doctor. I'm George Clooney. I inhabit roles. I don't play them. Listen, I've played a lawyer too, okay? I know as much about human rights. I did a UN movie.
All of the things you've played, I actually am.
No, I am.
No, you act.
No, I inhabit. I have you ever heard of method acting? End scene. That was George Clooney and his new wife arguing about the remote.
Clooney and Amal, part one.
Oh boy. Well, he's in for it. He's in for it. All right. Well, that wraps up the stories for the week. Should we give a shout out to some of our new Twitter followers?
Yes, please do.
All right. Let's see who we got. And only in law school, we've got we got a bunch. We had a good week. We had somebody named Brandy Arena retweeted us. Justine favored us. Morgan Lee followed us. Justin and Nicole tweeted at us. Alzana Braff, Cody Vadrine, Brittany Jones, Nizad Law Firm, Christine Bel Castro, KDS, Aaron McCabe, Claire Underwood, Josh Vincent, Patty Scanlon. Wow, we're killing it on Twitter.
That's great.
Yeah, and comedians at law. We had Go Cleo. We had Phi Alpha Delta Legal Fraternity. Guy Sakalidis. Terry Proctor, the Riverside County Bar, followed us. Very nice.
That's great. Keep following us. Keep sending us those tweets. Keep retweeting us.
And what should we ask people? What should we ask people to tweet us at this week, about George Clooney or about Sterling?
Yeah, both of them. I mean, I think. No.
This is what we should ask. How long do you think Clooney is gonna get stay married to Amal?
Yes.
Hashtag OLS. Or hashtag CAL. Just tweet us how many. I say the over under is 3 years.
I say they don't get married at all.
Oh, you don't even think it's gonna. Oh, you don't even think they're gonna make it to the altar.
I don't think they're gonna make it to the altar. Nope.
Ah, well, coming up, we have a great interview with Lee Pacquia. He's the host of Bloomberg Law for a long time, and now he started his own site. So that should be really interesting. And this was fun, Didi. We got to do it again. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast. We have a very special guest today. He's a lawyer turned host and television and web producer, and he recently just started a production company that does a lot of law-related production stuff. Welcome to the podcast, Lee Pacquia.
Hey there. Thank you.
So before we get into your company, I always like to start off with, you know, where you went to law school and how did that come to be?
Mm-hmm. Well, I went slightly later than most people tend to. I took a year off between college and grad school, and I worked in the finance space. And I went to law school probably 1 or 2 years out of college, and I attended New York Law School in Tribeca.
So I'm always curious, you know, the people who go the finance route. What was it about, you know, you didn't like that track or?
I liked it, but it was. You know, I always wanted to attend law school. My father had a law degree, and he worked in the bankruptcy and restructuring space. And in order to kind of have some level of career advancement, I just didn't see any way to do it without having a graduate degree of some kind, either an MBA or a master's of finance or a JD. So at the end of the day, I had a liberal arts degree for undergrad, and the law degree just kind of made sense. It was always something I thought I'd do, just made the most sense at the time. Pre-crash, of course.
I always like to ask people on the podcast, like, did you enjoy your time at law school, or do you look back fondly on it?
Yeah, no. I mean, I met a lot of great people, a lot of great professors. I was a classics major undergrad at a great liberal arts school in New England called Wesleyan University. It was a totally different experience from law school. I was expecting something a little bit more intellectual, a little bit more philosophical. In law school, you learn a lot of procedure, a lot of rules, where to go, when to file, that kind of thing. It wasn't exactly my cup of tea, but, you know, like many things in life, you do what you got to do to get ahead. And, you know, it was just kind of part of the process. Did I enjoy it? Certain aspects of it were fine. I certainly loved taking bankruptcy.
Who's your favorite professor over there? Like
Karen Gross was fantastic. She's no longer there. She's the president of a college in Vermont right now. But the bankruptcy course there was fantastic. Professor Nadine Strassen, great constitutional law professor, is still at NYLS. Just, you know, fantastic faculty and administration at the school. Can't say enough about it. Full disclosure, they are a client of my current company now.
Nice.
So.
Well, if anybody's listening...
I should throw that out there.
If anybody's listening from New York Law School, please tell those professors he's giving them a nice shout-out. So how did the Bloomberg... you guys are probably familiar with... most familiar with Lee through his work on Bloomberg TV. He hosted a show there. He did a lot of great interviews. How did that come to be?
Well, I took a year after law school, and I clerked for a bankruptcy judge in Trenton, New Jersey. So about 8 months into the clerkship, I was talking to a number of law firms about going the associate route and, you know, practicing law. And kind of late in the game, I got this interesting offer from Bloomberg Law to go in and write analysis and commentary for bankruptcy law professionals, and also people in the finance space who are interested in what's happening in the bankruptcy courts. A lot of money changes hands, and, you know, people are investing in the equity and the debt involved in bankruptcy cases, and they are looking for a trading edge, as it were. So we were thinking of products that might help them out and get them to use the Bloomberg terminal. About 2 years into that job, we had a lot of AV equipment lying around. Obviously, it's Bloomberg. We have a radio station, a TV station, all manner of media properties. And we got the idea to start making some podcasts. So I walked across the building to Tom Keen, who's one of the big anchors at Bloomberg TV, and I told him what we were thinking of doing, and he graciously offered to kind of show me the ropes and walk me through a couple of recordings. And we arranged a roundtable discussion on the future of Chapter 11 in the United States. And we just started throwing out kind of emails to see who might be interested in coming on. So I shot the moon, and I asked Judge Richard Posner in Chicago and Harvey Miller and a couple other Chapter 11 luminaries around the country, and a bunch of people said yes. So we had this crazy podcast with Tom Keen and myself kind of running the show, and we had Harvey Miller and Judge Richard Posner and Jamie Sprayragan from Kirkland Ellis was on the call as well, and we just talked for about half an hour about what's going to happen to Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code going forward. And we went from there. I mean, the second show, we got Elliot Spitzer to come on and talk about his views of the world. And, you know, the rest was kind of history.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Who was your sort of best or most fun interview you did over there?
We had a lot of great guests. You know, we had Paul Mercurio on the show, who's probably, you know, run across your radar screen a bunch of times.
Yeah,
he's a stand-up comedian. Who used to have a M&A practice at a big law firm. I really enjoyed talking to him. He's got a great story, and he's a really fun interview. So it wasn't the most substantive, you know, in terms of talking about what's happening in the news flow, but I certainly enjoyed that one a lot. We also had a great recurring guest with Lee Buchheit. He's the world's foremost expert on sovereign debt restructuring matter. So when a country runs out of money and can't pay its debts anymore, they call him in. Very professorial, very, very smart take on what's happening in some of the hotspots in the sovereign debt space. He came on and talked to us about Greece melting and Cyprus and all that stuff.
So we better call him when we run out of money.
I think that might be the plan. We might be talking to him already. Who knows?
I'm sure he's like Obama's first call.
Probably.
You know how those other third world countries ran out of money and you helped them out? Can you do that at home?
For this discreetly as possible, hopefully.
Yeah. You have to sign a confidentiality agreement here.
Right. I'm sure he'd be willing to.
Do you feel like you learned a lot about, you know, macro issues doing all this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, you know, it was fun. When we got about a year into the project, we brought on Ed Adams from the ABA Journal. He ran the web news website over there, and he gave us more of a journalistic structure at what we were doing. So I went on a schedule where I did three shows a week, one on bankruptcy, one on law firm economics, and another on legal issues in the news flow. And, you know, you're recording three shows a week. You have to be able to really quickly source and research and talk about a variety of topics in a very short time frame, which is daunting. But once you figure out the workflow and everything, it's also a lot of fun because you're covering a lot of different areas. I mean, we live in a really complicated, quickly evolving world, and the ability to study and talk about this kind, so many different kinds of things, was really a cool experience. I look back on those years fondly.
So let's move to the now. So you started this company. It's called Mimesis.
Mm-hmm. Mimesis.
Mimesis. Sorry.
And, no worries.
It seems like you've got you know, an interesting idea here, because it seems like law firms and law schools, and just in terms of video production of legal stuff, we're kind of behind, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as all professional service providers go, I think law is probably the slowest to adopt video as a business development or crisis management or marketing tool. You know, some people point to the real estate space or consulting as having, you know, more of a willingness to jump in and utilize what video can do to sell their services or communicate with the public at large. Law firms are I'm finding they're willing to try this medium. The way they go about it differs from firm to firm.
How are they going about it? I mean, give us an example of somebody you're working with them. What are they doing?
Well, we're working with New York Law School. They're our first client. We produce 5 videos a month for them. We put professors on camera to talk about how their expertise dovetails with items of import in the news flow. We just signed a deal with a very well-known global international firm that's going to be going into production with us in about a week or two. So we'll be able to talk about who exactly it is very, very shortly.
And what do they want you to do for them? What kind of videos would a law firm, or what are your ideas for what a law firm should have?
This particular firm wants to go on camera for 10 to 15 minutes to talk about items in the news flow and how they have experts at the firm that can shed light on what's happening in a particular space. So
sort of sort of infomercial type, I guess you could say?
Yeah, more like a deep dive interview. You know, we'll sit down at a table, kind of Charlie Rose style, and talk to, say, you know, a private equity partner about what's happening in his or her own business space, what their clients are worried about, and what this means for the macro economy. Very, very similar to the stuff that I was doing at Bloomberg. But, you know, sometimes people are going to be paying for the right to come on the show and talk about what they're doing. Sometimes not. You know, we're going to kind of take a page from the Gawkers and the BuzzFeeds of the world, and we're going to monetize ourselves through sponsored content. It's going to be compelling. It's going to be interesting and noteworthy at the end of the day. We're just going to shift the economic focus of the enterprise in a direction away from the traditional advertising model.
Yeah, and I mean, do you think there's a hesitancy from firms because of just sort of like just law firms are conservative, or is it like a fear of exposing things? I mean, what is this? Why doesn't every firm have this now?
I think they're getting there. I think they're getting to the point where they're realizing that we've talked about how the legal industry in the United States is changing very, very quickly. It's not as easy to come by work as it used to be. So everyone realizes that at one point or another, they're going to be forced to try new things in terms of getting new business in the door. Video, it's certainly scary. You always worry about someone going on camera and saying something stupid. But if done in the right environment with people who are comfortable and capable on camera, things can go perfectly fine. It's just a matter of trying something different.
And are you going to be hosting the, these interview panels at the firms?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some of them. Sometimes we're going to be shooting shows where a producer is off camera kind of spitballing questions at the subject, and they'll be kind of, talking to just the camera, so almost like a monologue format. We'll be bringing in different hosts and launching new shows. We have our first show out called The Business of Law, where we talk about law firm economics and the challenges facing the law school sector and legal tech startups. It's an evolving project. We're only about 10 weeks in, but
it's exciting, isn't it? Starting your own.
I'm happy with the progress we've made so thus far. Yeah, it is. It sure is different. You forget about all the things that you kind of take for granted when you're operating in a large organization like Bloomberg. But it's exciting, and I've been pleased with the results thus far.
Yeah, and I always ask people who've gone through it, you know, what advice would you have for law students about their careers, or specifically for those people who might want to go the route that you went.
Right. It's never too early to start thinking seriously about these questions. You know, I saw a lot of people in my time at law school kind of take an approach where it's like, well, I'm going to take this class or take this class or maybe this clinic, and I'm just going to wait for, my career path and my desires just to manifest out of thin air. That does happen sometimes, and it's wonderful when people are fortunate to have that happen to them. But I also saw a lot of people who waited simply too long. And then they were in a position when they're out of law school, just taking whatever job they could get, and then, agonizing about how they're going to transition their career path back to a trajectory that would be, more fulfilling, more rewarding, or more enjoyable. The law school experience goes awfully quick. I would strongly encourage people who are embarking on that journey to figure out what's going to come next as soon as possible.
Yeah, especially with these employment numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I don't see it turning around anytime soon. I think there's a lot of things that you can do with a law degree. It's a great education. But the idea that you're just going to graduate from one system to another and just fall into an arrangement in a firm the way most people did 10, 15 years ago is just not today's reality.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that sort of middle ground is disappearing too. I mean, I think there's mm-hmm. still spots at the big top firms and for people to start their own small practices. But
on the same note, we are seeing a tremendous interest in the legal tech startup space. I think to use a tired phrase, it's primed for disruption. A lot of people are going to try and fail at starting companies that are going to offer technological solutions to problems posed in the legal profession and industry. There are going to be jobs created there one way or another. How exactly it's going to pan out, I can't say right now. But, with every contraction, there's also an expansion. So there are going to be things that people can do with law degrees. It's just going to be a difficult process figuring out exactly what it's going to be.
Yeah, I think that's right. We've interviewed a couple of people working in the legal tech space. I think that has, far to go still as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. It's a long, frustrating process for people involved in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, before I let you go, I just want to give you a chance to, we like to give the floor to you to promote, your new company, tell people how to find you, what you can do for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the company is Mimesis Productions, and our first vertical is devoted to law, so it's Mimesis Law. We're on YouTube. We're on JD Super, which is a great platform for content related to the legal profession. And you can, of course, follow us on Twitter. We're at Mimesis Web TV. We'll have a website coming hopefully next month. And we're going to be putting out some great content. So I hope your viewers make the trip over to come and see us.
Yeah, please check it out. And Lee and I were talking about maybe doing something together. So
right on. Yeah, I hope you can come on the show sometime soon next time you're in New York.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Lee. And we will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Matt. Have a good one.
Thanks. You too. That concludes this week's podcast. Thank you guys for listening, and we will talk to you next week.